Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest from Russia after President Putin's marathon TV chat with the nation, in which he criticized the US for not wanting partners or allies, but instead treating other powers as vassal states. Marcia Gessen, who is just back from Moscow, joins us to discuss the latest crackdown on what's left of the political opposition and her new book just out, The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. Then we'll look into the deepening quagmire for Saudi Arabia in Yemen that has U.S. officials worried about the humanitarian crisis caused by indiscriminate bombing and how the Saudi intervention has emboldened the so-called al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. We'll speak with Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who joins us to discuss the hidden agendas in Yemen as thousands of Yemeni troops pledge allegiance to the exile leader Hadi, while most of Yemen's military remains loyal to the ex-president, who is allied with the Houthi rebels. Then finally, on the 20th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing, in which 168 Americans were killed, many of them preschool children, Andrew Gumbel joins us. He is the author of Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters, and we will discuss his latest article at The Guardian, Oklahoma City Bombing 20 Years Later, Key Questions Remain Unanswered. And joining us now is Marcia Gessen, who's a Russian-American journalist who was fired as editor of the Russian magazine Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with the cranes. Her books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, and her latest book about the Sanarov brothers just out is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marcia Gessen.
Hi, and good to be here.
And the Sanarov brothers bombing, the anniversary was last week, and the sentencing, I think he was sentenced on all, the remaining brother, the younger one, was sentenced on all 30 charges, and it remains to be seen whether he gets the death penalty. And of course, here we are today talking about another anniversary, the 20th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. But you're just back from Russia, and President Putin just had his long, I think it was about 4 hour long television chat with the nation. And then the following day, we learn that the political opposition in Russia formed an anti-Putin alliance with Navalny's Party of Progress, joining with the party of the slain leader Nemtsov. And another party called Democratic Choice, led by a former energy minister. So just if you would, before we talk about the Sanarov brothers, give me a sense of how the opposition is faring there, given Putin's confident attitude on his long television address, as though he's thoroughly vanquished any opposition and is, you know, in effect, the new czar.
I'm afraid in that sense, Putin is probably more accurate in his perception than some of the opposition is. I wouldn't even use the word opposition when we're talking about Russia, because using the word opposition implies that people who are opposed to Putin have access to electoral mechanisms and the media in ways that they don't. The media is almost completely dominated by the Kremlin and has been for many years. There's basically one independent magazine left, and one struggling internet-based television channel. That's it. So the vast majority of the Russian people, and by vast majority I mean over 98%, get all their information from outlets that are controlled by the state. Access to the ballot is virtually non-existent, as is the ballot itself. I mean, basically, there are only direct elections of the president and some very low-level local offices. Everything else has been, elections have been either abolished or turned into sort of a convoluted representative system that basically is not an election at all, not to mention the fact that they're rigged, not to mention that the opposition doesn't have access to media. So, you know, when you talk about forming an alliance, that's probably a good thing, sort of a good strategy, because people get practice, people get to work together, people get to run campaigns. But it risks creating the impression that they are actually able to participate in elections, which is absolutely not true.
So what was your sense then, having just been in Russia, Marcia Gessen, of what the Russian people think about in terms of the economy being under stress because of sanctions, the drop in oil prices, the extent to which the sanctions are entirely related to Crimea and Ukraine. I understand most people are in a propaganda bubble of victimhood, as opposed to, I mean, it's pretty clear that the Ukrainians did not invade Russia, but you would think that was the case. So where does that stand in terms of the idea that Western sanctions would perhaps alter Putin's behavior? Are they being felt, and or are they reinforcing support for Putin?
Well, those are really two different questions. The sanctions are absolutely being felt, as are the counter-sanctions. I mean, the way that Russia responded to the imposition of economic sanctions by the United States and the European Union was by imposing its own sanctions on European imports, which actually created further hardships for the Russian people. And but, you know, the question is, was the idea that sanctions would influence Putin's behavior sound in the first place? And I argued at the time, and I continue to argue that no. Sanctions, there's no way that sanctions can influence Putin's behavior. But the problem is, nothing can influence Putin's behavior. Putin is dead set on a strategy of escalation, and he's going to escalate until the system implodes. Will the sanctions bring that moment closer? We have no way of knowing. Right. So really, the way to evaluate sanctions is not by asking whether they're influencing Putin's behavior, because they can't. And many of us knew from the beginning that they couldn't. But to ask, are they the right thing to do? And I would argue, yes, they're the right thing to do. It is not right to continue to do business with a dictator.
So Putin, of course, has sold or revived the sale of anti-aircraft missiles to Iran. And this, of course, most people think that has a lot to do with a possible Israeli attack on Iran. It certainly has upset Israel, but then Israel has apparently decided to sell military equipment to Ukraine, which has upset, in turn, Vladimir Putin. What's the sense in Russia, though, of what's happening in Ukraine? Are they aware that this has caused tremendous divisions throughout the world, and that there is a connection, even if the sanctions aren't hurting? And I think, I imagine, on the big May the 9th parade at the end of World War II, the absence of Western participation perhaps will be noticed.
Oh, Russians have long since absorbed the message that the West is against Russia, that the West doesn't respect Russia. So they will see the absence of Western leaders at the celebration as another sign of the fact that that the West has no respect for the thing that they hold most sacred, which is their victory in World War II. They will not draw a link between that and Ukraine and Russian aggression in Ukraine, because they also don't believe in Russian aggression in Ukraine. They've been told that that Russia is trying to defend itself in Ukraine against United States aggression.
So when Putin says to the nation on television that Russia doesn't see anyone as an enemy, and that we're essentially beleaguered, and the Americans don't want allies, they just want vassal states, all that plays well, I take it. That's the collective mindset.
That is very much the line that Russia has adopted. It appears to be the line that most Russians are quite comfortable with. How deeply held those beliefs are is an open question. It's a very, very difficult thing to measure in an authoritarian country. But I actually think those particular beliefs really are very deeply held, and they reach back to the Soviet period. So, you know, people are well prepared to adopt them and absorb them, and they're probably more comfortable with them than the brief period of Russian-American friendship in the 90s.
So the work that you've done, for example, in your book, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, which really documents the extraordinary numbers of tragedies that have taken place in Russia, and assassinations, etc., that do seem to be inextricably linked to Vladimir Putin. And he was asked about the assassination of the opposition figure Boris Nemtsov, and Putin said it was tragic and shameful. But again, arresting the Chechen, or the Chechens that they have, is almost an exact replica of what happened with Anna Politkovskaya. I guess once again, I'm not there, and I'm looking at it from a Western perspective, but you get the impression that people must notice the absolute hollow nature of these denials and the extraordinary coincidences of all of these political deaths.
Well,
did we lose her again?
Apart.
No, that's
well, those murders are 9 years apart, or 8.5 years apart. Also, that trope that that it's the Chechens who pulled the trigger, that has a lot of traction. In fact, it may or may not have been accurate. The problem with those investigations is that they have no credibility whatsoever. I mean, we actually don't even have we have as much reason to say that that they probably have the wrong people as we have reason to say that they probably have the wrong people, which is to say we have zero information. But, you know, I think the more relevant thing to what's happening with the way people perceive these political murders is that Nemtsov was very widely perceived as not just an enemy of Putin, but an enemy of the people. And that is Putin's line right now. It's really harking back to Stalinism. It's employing all of that rhetoric of traitors and the fifth column. That's the way he talks about people who oppose him. So I wouldn't overestimate the amount of sympathy and pain that Nemtsov's murder has caused to anyone but a very, very small circle of oppositions.
So in other words, but the average person, because he was against the war in Ukraine, the idea that because he's a traitor in the eyes of so many people, and that's the line that the Kremlin's been pushing, then it's quite possible that some patriot took it upon himself to shoot him.
That seems very likely. Yeah. I mean, this is a murder that took place in plain view of the Kremlin. Nemtsov was murdered while he was under surveillance by the Secret Services, as he was almost constantly, and especially on the eve of a large opposition march, which was planned for the next day. So this was a crime that, at the very least, was allowed to happen, and at most was actually ordered by the Kremlin.
So let's turn to your new book, Masha Gessen, The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy.
It's a bit of a sharp turn, yes.
It is a bit of a sharp turn, but in a way, you know, the Chechen tragedy is very much, at least the last Chechen war was very much Putin's war. It launched him. And how much of these, do you think these brothers are a product of the chaos and tragedy that caused?
Well, you know, it's tricky to say that anybody that a terrorist is the product of another.
Right. Hello? Did we lose it again?
Yeah, I'm here.
Sorry, it keeps dropping out. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah.
I'm in the States, but anyway, I don't want to come off sounding like I'm justifying what they did, right? There are many, many people, including young men, including alienated young men, who were refugees from the war in Chechnya, who haven't blown anybody up. So it is not a normal reaction to great suffering and dislocation. At the same time, in the Tsarnaya story, those things played a huge role. The fact that they came from a Chechen family that had been deported to Central Asia in 1944 by Stalin, that lived in exile their entire lives, and that they themselves, the brothers, the brothers were moved great distances as their parents continued to try to find a place where they wouldn't feel dislocated, where they would feel at home. That's how they landed in the United States. And they brought with them that pain of dislocation and that sense that they were always embattled, which they always had been.
Well, of course, they were allowed into the United States as refugees, right, from political violence.
They got asylum in the United States. Sure. It's slightly different, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, and at the same time, you know, they had the bad luck to land here right after 9/11. They got here in 2002. And I think that some of the attitudes that they perceived quite accurately actually mirrored the attitudes they had encountered in the former Soviet Union, you know, where the Muslims were always suspect, where there was a direct link in a lot of people's minds between the idea of Muslims and the idea of terrorists. So I think that it was a shock to them that this promised land, where they were told things would be different, sometimes felt very, very similar.
Well, of course, it's been also, I think, a shock to the American people in the sense that, you know, give me your tired, your poor, and your huddled masses, and American generosity was repaid in this way. Do you detect that in the sense that, you know, obviously relations between Russia and the United States are souring, and a lot of internet crime comes from Russia. Are they sort of feeding that narrative to the brothers, do you think?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I don't get the sense that a lot of people are acutely aware that they come from Russia. I think the fact that they're Muslim immigrants continues to be so much more important in the public perception of this case and related cases. And in fact, in the book, I describe one of the related cases, the obstruction of justice trial that preceded the trial of the younger bomber, where you saw one American-born man and two Muslim immigrant men who were tried for the same crimes and treated vastly differently. And it was very, very clear that the entire U.S. justice system treated them differently because one of them was American-born Christian and the other two were Muslim and immigrant.
Well, there was also a couple of things that were missed. One was, of course, Russia's warning, however clear it was, of the older brother's possible connections to Islamic terrorism, and that's not exactly the right way to put it, but to terrorism. There was also the shooting of the college kids over the marijuana deal, and that had an extraordinary conclusion too, which you write about in your book, where they get a confession and a minute later the guy is killed by the FBI.
Right. So, yeah, you were talking about the murder or the killing, in May 2013, right, in Florida,
right,
of a man named Ibrahim Tadashev, who was a friend of Tamerlan Tranaz, who was being interrogated by the FBI and the Massachusetts State Police at the time of his death. He was shot by an FBI agent, supposedly because he became aggressive while writing his confession. There have been two internal investigations. Well, one internal investigation, one investigation by the Florida State Attorney, that do seem to show that he did become aggressive, although that doesn't really go all the way to explaining why an FBI agent would have felt compelled to fire seven shots at him, including three in the back and one in the back of the head. But that whole story is still very muddled. We still don't know whether Tamerlan Tranaev really was connected to the triple murder in Waltham, Massachusetts in 2011, whether Ibrahim Tadashev was his accomplice. Tadashev's confession was never completed, and it's very problematic. It has many errors in it, so it almost reads like he didn't actually have knowledge of the crime. And of course, the Massachusetts State Police and the Massachusetts District Attorney still haven't said that they've solved the murder. So they haven't actually named Tamerlan Tsarnaev as the culprit. And as for the first thing you brought up, the Russians' warning to the FBI that they believed Tamerlan Tsarnaev was a terrorism risk. This was when Tamerlan was living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This was in 2011. And the FBI interviewed Tamerlan Tsarnaev at least three times. And then he was able to go on and hatch a plot and build six bombs and detonate two of them at the Boston Marathon. Very soon after he had been fingered and interviewed by the FBI. And in fact, even after his image was isolated by investigators from the surveillance tapes, he remained unidentified. So somehow the FBI managed to not recognize him in the picture even after the bombing. There are many, many odd questions about what happened with Tamer Lamchar and I's relationship with the FBI, and I use the word relationship loosely. What I'm saying is that, you know, you and I have talked three times. We have some sort of relationship. The FBI interviewed Tamer Lamchar and I three times. Did they stop watching him? Did they believe he was under control? Did he think that he was an informant? We know that at some point they tried to recruit him as an informant. Many open questions that no one has asked and that remain unanswered.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Marcia Gessen. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Marcia Gessen, who's a Russian-American journalist who was fired as editor of the Russian magazine Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with the cranes. Her books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. And her latest book about the Sonara brothers just out is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the deepening quagmire for Saudi Arabia in Yemen.
From Russia with love I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for more than two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and Breaking Faith, a novel, and his latest book, Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And this deepening quagmire, if that's the right way to describe Saudi's involvement in Yemen, it certainly got the U.S. concerned about how it's emboldened al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But it's also, I think, there's widespread concern about the humanitarian nature of the disaster, with bodies in the street. Apparently, the bombing by Saudi Arabian airplanes is fairly indiscriminate. There's a sense that the king's younger son, who's directing this war, the new defense minister, may be out of his depth. But are the Saudis just sort of fed up with the U.S. and just decided, you know, to hell with it, and they're going to go ahead and do something on their own?
Well, I think all those factors are at play here. Very definitely, we have a startlingly new younger generation with the king's son. I believe he's in his 20s still, or... but more to the point about the son is that of all the various sons kicking around to have some claim down the road towards kingship, possibly, he's the only one who hasn't even been educated outside the country. So he's really a homegrown product without a lot of global experience with in international relations, and very ambitious. And this probably sees himself, and his father may see himself, as the transition from the old generation to a much younger generation, which, of course, is long overdue. But that's not going to go down that easily within the royal family, because there are other members, of course, who see themselves as entitled to it and certainly don't want to jump generations quite that quickly. So I think if this prince gets in over his head, there may be some significant number of Saudi royalty who are not altogether unhappy.
And these are the ones that are, some of them are still sort of feeling bruised by the purging of some of the older figures, like the former defense minister and the two gatekeepers, the sort of Cardinal Richelieu's Tuileries, I think they were called.
Yeah, exactly. And also, it marks something of a departure for Saudi Arabia, which has generally been pretty cautious about getting involved in overt warfare outside the country. There are some exceptions. They haven't intervened somewhat here and there in Yemen in particular, in South Yemen. But it's been generally a more covert, undercover type of stuff. In this case, it's pretty open warfare, and it's been openly trumpeted, and they've tried to call in around themselves some 10 allies to support what they saw as the grand struggle against Shiism and Iran. So they've really put this in a high-profile operation, and failure will therefore be that much greater given the publicity around it.
But in spite of their generous checkbook, trying to get the Pakistanis involved and also Egypt, who already have their painful history of intervention in Yemen, they're not being too successful, are they?
No, I don't think so. In fact, what we're beginning to see now is a possibly very dramatic shift in some of the geopolitical configurations around the area as a result. You know, these things change fast, and you can prognosticate and spin significant theories about what may be happening on a small database. But nonetheless, it's quite striking that Pakistan, which has been a long-time ally and military supporter of Saudi Arabia, sort of a backup defense force, if you will, in the Gulf, Pakistan opted out in the end from joining Saudi Arabia in this, despite the open call from Riyadh for them to join. I think they figured this was just a little bit too much of a reach, an unsuccessful outcome. And interestingly, China, which weighed in by saying, by advising anyway, the Pakistanis, that this might not be such a good idea, and the Chinese, at least unofficial commentary, suggested that that this is not really quite the struggle that Saudi Arabia is making it out to be against militant Iranian expansionism or Shiite expansionism. And then there's Turkey. We can talk about that if you'd like, but there's been a sudden and marked turnaround there as well, and both of these turnarounds favor Iran strongly.
And again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also serves as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and his latest, Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. So let's turn to those meetings that took place where the Turkish very assertive new president visited Saudi Arabia and then more recently visited Iran. There is a perceptible shift then towards Iran and away from Saudi Arabia on the part of Turkey?
Yeah, I wouldn't quite want to call it a decisive shift towards Iran, but Turkey, for the first 10 years of the ruling party in power, the AKP party, had been very successful in standing above sectarian struggles. Neither Shiite nor Sunni, even though it's a large, predominantly Sunni country, but they had sought to stay out of trouble and struggles in the region and to try to mediate. But they broke this standing policy a couple of years ago and have gotten sucked into all kinds of complex issues as a result of the Arab Spring, none of which have been successful for Turkey either in the last few years. It dragged them into fighting in Syria with the Saudis, and they've been back and forth on how close they wanted to be with Saudi Arabia. For example, Turkey is generally supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Saudis have denounced it as a terrorist organization starting a couple of years ago. So Turkey, after the visit to Tehran, Erdogan, the president, began to change his tune and decided that it wasn't really the struggle that he thought it would be, and Turkey's been backing away from it. So Iran, in the interim, therefore, has talked Turkey. It's not the only, it's not just Iran's Iran's influence, but for other reasons as well in Turkish policies. But the upshot is that Iran has brought around both Pakistan and Turkey away from the Saudi so-called United Sunni Front against Iran, and that's quite a significant diplomatic accomplishment.
And conversely, the P5+1 outreach and deal with Iran, which obviously involves the United States, it could be enormously significant, but there's this element of the U.S. Being, the door has now been opened through the Senate for some possible interference. And my sense is that, the president did what he could to keep the Congress out. A lot of analysts say, well, it's okay, it's better to have them in on the deal than shut out, because they're going to be more likely to want to sabotage it if they feel shut out as opposed to if they've been read into it. But my sense is that this could be the opening wedge to try and scuttle it on the U.S. side. How do you read it?
I think you're make a significant point there, Ian. I'd have to say, though, I think in the end, when all these various games are played between Obama and Congress, and especially the Republicans, I sort of feel good about this U.S.-Iranian relationship in a way that I don't feel very good about almost anything else happening out there in the region. But somehow I just feel that this is going to work. It's been going on long enough and it's proceeded along enough lines that I'm sort of cautiously positive that it's going to come out very well. And this, as we've all said, this is a game changer in the Middle East, because it suddenly means that Iran is now no longer a pariah, at least in the eyes of the United States and its allies, and will be a more significant player. Certainly, this is one of the things that upsets Saudi Arabia, and I think you know Obama has found himself caught out in this Yemeni game, because I think he was really very worried about breaking with Saudi Arabia over the Yemen issue, after he's already almost broken with Saudi Arabia on issues of the Iran talks, nuclear talks. So I suspect that the U.S. figured that they were better off moving everything out of Yemen, the embassy and everything into Riyadh, and at least advising, quote unquote, the Saudis, providing some logistical and intelligence support, but also maybe in a position to try to keep the Saudis from making more colossal errors, and at least demonstrating that they haven't abandoned them. But, it's a tough call either way, because the U.S. is not in a good position supporting this war when China and Russia and Iran and everybody else says, no, we've got to have negotiations. There's no military solution.
Well, the one thing that's been the U.S.'s main focus in Yemen, and they've basically been more concerned about the air warfare of drone strikes then apparently conditions on the ground, then the only sense of purpose there was to go after al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But now U.S. officials are saying that that the Saudi intervention has emboldened AQIP. And the U.S., I mean, surely they've got to be concerned if that's been their main focus. And that looks like it's really blown up in their face.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's. I think one of the reasons that the al-Qaeda forces in Yemen have benefited from this is simply from the chaos. The war has been going on now for a couple of months, and they've been able to expand their forces. Even hints of ISIS, the Islamic State, being able to try to stir up or win over some support there as well. So it's kind of a lose-lose situation, I think, for Washington, because the Houthis, who are now pretty well victorious in the country, also hate al-Qaeda and hate the Islamic State, and yet here Washington is sort of stuck fighting the Houthis. So, it's kind of a lose-lose game for Washington.
So, what's your sense then of whether or not the Iran deal could go through? And if so, I know it's got the Saudis really concerned, and perhaps they're being striking out, you know, because they're so afraid that they're going to be left out in the cold. But a lot of people think that's not such a bad idea, because our relationship with the Saudis has not been exactly without duplicity, shall we say, it's pretty clear that there's a theological link, if you will, to al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, al-Shabaab, all of these terrorist groups that have got us beset with the Saudis, with this Wahhabism.
Well, that's right. There's no doubt that Wahhabi principles do lie behind some of this most militant ideology. You can be a Wahhabi and not be a terrorist, or not be fighting in for jihad. But the principles, the theological principles, as you suggest, have been very negative, and including Saudi Arabia's obsessive pressing, emphasizing this sectarian struggle, which it isn't really in Yemen. It's much more internal conflicts within Yemen and Shiites fighting Shiites within, or at least competing with Shiites within Yemen. So the clear-cut picture of you know, stopping Iranian aggression and Shiite aggression is I think kind of nonsensical. The Iranians haven't fought outside their borders in centuries. Have not invaded anybody except briefly during that Iran-Iraq war, back and forth over the border, which Iraq started and won. I think this is what really upsets Saudis and other kingdoms, other monarchs in the region, is the fact that Iran essentially represents a revolutionary force, revolutionary in the sense that they reject kingship. They call for parliamentary democracy, and Iran does have a parliamentary democracy. It's not fully fair. It's skewed in many respects, but they have real elections with real differences in the outcome. As we've seen, this recent whole nuclear stuff came out of the result of the recent elections in Iran a year or so ago. So it's the symbolism of getting rid of Western imperialism, standing down the United States where possible, make the Middle East for Middle Easterners, and not a Shiite-Sunni thing. So the Iranians are not supporting Shiism as such. They'll support oppressed Shia, but they never speak in the name of Shiism as such. So the Saudis are really afraid of, I think, of this revolutionary implications of a state like Iran, which had a genuine revolution, has a sort of a crudely functioning democracy, and is not the kind of state that Saudi Arabia wants to see or the kinds of change or reforms that Saudi Arabia wants to see. Riyadh's afraid of it.
So, but just in closing, are the Republican hardliners who are opposed to this deal, the Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, who's opposed to this deal, and the Saudis who are opposed to this deal, is there a sort of rejectionist alliance forming out there?
There could be. Certainly, you're absolutely right that those three forms come together. It's a kind of an unholy alliance in many respects, mixing the Israelis with the Saudis. But, you know, in the end, Ian, I don't think this is going to work. I think somehow there's a deep internal and historical logic to ultimately, after, you know, 35 years or more of American, Iranian freeze out in relations, I think there's a logic that's going to cause this to work in the end, and most of the world strongly supports it. So I think the Saudis are in the end going to have to suck it up. They've lived with Iran in the past before, and they're going to have to do it again. But the Saudis sadly represent today a counter-revolutionary front in the Arab world, and that is not what the Arab world needs. The Arab world does need change, and some of it may be messy, but change has got to come.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the 20th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing.
Cause things the same because we like the same color, and that's gray. Now that's May. Can't burn his cross cause he can't afford the gasoline. Now if a Muslim woman strapped with a bomb on the bus with the seconds running give you the jitters, just imagine an American based Christian organization planning to poison water supplies to bring the second coming quicker.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as a foreign correspondent for The Guardian in Europe, the Middle East, and the United States, and is the author of several books, including Steal This Vote and Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. His latest article at The Guardian is Oklahoma City Bombing 20 Years Later, Key Questions Remain Unanswered. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Gumbel.
Thank you so much.
And the 20th anniversary ceremonies have been underway today in Oklahoma City, 20 years after 168 Americans were killed, many of them preschool children. President Bill Clinton spoke. And but I take it from the book that you've written and from the article in The Guardian, the whole story hasn't been told, right? There's some very key missing pieces here. So let's start out with what you think is the biggest omission in our recollection and the historical record.
Well, I think the most helpful way to start is to say it's not a surprise that on the 20th anniversary, the tone is somber. It's about recollection. It's about remembering the victims. That's entirely appropriate, and I'm certainly not questioning that. But I think after 20 years, it's time to be able to look back at how the story was presented by the government and in the media as really one of great success. Frank Keating, who was the governor of Oklahoma at the time, said two evil men did this, two evil men paid, and that just isn't the whole story. What we're really missing, or what the investigators missed most saliently, is an opportunity to really get to grips with the culture of the radical far right. What fueled this particular attack, what it may have been part of, which was clearly, and by the testimony of many, many people, a broader war against the government. This was supposed to be the opening salvo. It was in itself a failure. The killing, especially of the children in the daycare center, was something that even the radical far right found abhorrent. Against their interest, they wanted to get public support for what they were doing. This was going 180 degrees in the other direction. So what we got from the government, from the courts, from the media, overwhelmingly, is the story that the prosecution wanted to tell at trial. And there's nothing about the prosecutors that was, you know, dishonest about this, or in any way, you know, conspiring to hide anything. They needed to make a case against McVeigh and afterwards against Nichols. They desperately wanted to get not only a conviction against McVeigh, but also the death penalty. They succeeded. They also wanted to get a conviction and the death penalty against Terry Nichols. They only got the conviction and only on one charge, because his lawyers demonstrated very ably how the government had not made its case in several crucial respects. And what we also don't get is the whole backstory of dysfunction within law enforcement in the United States, which is a crucially important piece of this story that, had it been known at the time, could have made material difference in the run-up to 9/11, avoiding the repeat of the same mistakes. What we're talking about is agents who gave warnings that were disregarded, higher up who refused to share information with competitor agencies rather than pooling that information and making a plan to deal with it together, and a fundamental lack of understanding of the threat from certain parts of the radical far right. The focus then, as now, was on the Middle East. And in fact, when the Oklahoma City bombing first occurred, the first conventional wisdom in Washington, if not necessarily on the ground, was that this was Middle Easterners. And it took longer than it should have done to make that idea go away.
Of course, that was Steve Emerson's famous reporting where they, a couple of hapless Jordanians were arrested. But I think a lot of our listeners, Andrew Gumbel, will recall that both Timothy McVeigh and Nichols were caught incredibly quickly. And I mean, McVeigh, because apparently his car was unregistered and he was carrying a gun, not exactly a skillful tradecraft in a getaway. They basically had them within a few hours, didn't they?
Well, they got very lucky with McVeigh. They got McVeigh within 48 hours. They could have actually got him a little faster. One of the things I discovered was that the head of the Oklahoma Highway Patrol, which was the agency that brought him into custody on the gun and the license plate charges, or the gun charges what got him into custody, actually had tried to tip off the FBI on the day of his arrest, which was just 90 minutes after the bombing, that they had someone heading for the Kansas border. Maybe the FBI would like to take a look at this guy. And the FBI, for whatever reason, either because they didn't credit the Highway Patrol as being significant enough or because they were inundated in leads, chose to disregard that particular piece of information. But anyway, they got McVeigh just in time before he was released on bail. And then they got Terry Nichols, as you say, and they were also after, at the time, Nichols' brother James in Michigan. That was already the beginning of the end of their luck, to the extent that both Nichols brothers heard that the FBI was after them on the radio. In other words, there were media leaks way too early, which again is in the nature of a huge investigation in response to a massive attack, unprecedented in the United States in modern history. So, you know, I'm not being churlish in my criticisms here, but just to point out that the luck ran out pretty fast. And the main thing that eluded the investigators was a way quickly to get to other co-conspirators. They believed at the beginning there were other co-conspirators. They put out composite sketches of other co-conspirators. And there were two things that went wrong. One was they didn't get lucky enough to find somebody, but also there were specific avenues of investigation that may have led them in the right direction that were actually systematically closed down because they shed light on the failings of both the FBI, the ATF, and other agencies in the run-up to the bombing. And it also was a question of bureaucratic internal warfare within the FBI. Louis Freeh was trying to purge the agency of people he didn't like and used the bombing as an excuse to do that with some very senior investigators who would have been ideal leaders of the quest for the full conspiracy, and they were shunted aside, and it created a tremendous amount of bureaucratic ill will and inefficiency in the investigation, all of which has never really been told, you know, I could say, you know, in that sort of rather wink-wink way, except by me. The point being that for the book I wrote a couple of years ago, I managed to get access, together with my co-author, to the full government investigative files, and also managed to speak to most of the senior investigators, a lot of the rank-and-file street agents, if you told me, you know, blow by blow what went on, and the picture that they painted after the requisite time not to have to toe the line of the agency that they used to work for is very, very different from the simple, we found the perpetrators, we prosecuted them, end of story.
So again, I'm speaking with Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as a foreign correspondent for The Guardian in Europe, the Middle East, and the United States, and is the author of several books, including Steal This Vote and Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. And his latest article at The Guardian is Oklahoma City Bombing 20 Years Later, Key Questions Remain Unanswered. So let's turn to ground zero for the far right, this place called Elohim City. What role did it play?
Elohim City is a community in the remote eastern part of Oklahoma, what used to be known as Indian Country back in the days of the Wild West. It was settled by a former Mennonite from Canada called Bob Millar, and most of the people who lived there were followers of his very quirky version of the Christian religion that involved a heavy, overtly racist element. But he also opened the place up to passing criminals, radicals, people who were talking about revolution against the government. It was not the only place in the country like this. It's worth emphasizing there was a whole network of people who, like McVeigh, were very peripatetic. They went all over the place all the time. But Elohim City was one place where they tended to meet up, and specifically a lot of them were there in the few days just before the bombing. Interestingly, starting at about the 16th of April, so 3 days ahead of time, they started leaving in a great rush, ostensibly to find themselves alibis. There are one or two characters who don't have an alibi for the 19th, who were not investigated by the task force that looked into the bombing, and I spent a great deal of time in my research trying to work out why. But Elohim City was also a place where the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, had an informant, a very effective one. For several months, they were looking at a local Ku Klux Klan leader called Dennis Mahon. She started hearing about bombings, shootings, assassinations, revolution, war. She reported all this back, and the ATF, which 2 years earlier had been humiliated at Waco when they initiated the siege that the FBI then botched the end of, they were very afraid of acting on the informant's information. So what did they do? The head of the ATF at the time told me, we closed down the operation because we didn't want to have to act on her information. Had she stayed even a week or two longer past the point where she was formally shut down, she might well have been there to see Timothy McVeigh himself arrive, try and recruit people for his bombing. She may have been able to give more specific information, and according to John McGaw, the head of the ATF at the time, the bombing may well have been thwarted. We don't know for a fact that McVeigh visited, but once you start looking closely at the evidence and once you start talking to the senior investigators and start hearing about reports that went up to the Department of Justice that were not included in the public record, it becomes not only possible but really very likely that he did exactly that. Who he recruited, what he recruited them for, whether it was just for an auxiliary role, whether it was to actually carry out the bombing with him on the morning, unfortunately, at this point, we don't know, and it's doubtful at this point that we could find out, even if there was a political will, to start issuing subpoenas and re-interviewing people, which is a great frustration and a loss, I think.
But, Andrew Gumbel, is there an explanation then in as much as after Waco and that a lot of federal authorities simply don't want to stir up these hornet's nests? I mean, what explains why they didn't track down these other leads?
Well, what I say in the book is, you know, there were good reasons not to act, which is they didn't want to, in the moment, do a specific thing to chase a specific individual that could either compromise a bigger case that some other agency was trying to make against that individual, or they didn't want to put their agents in danger for a relatively small payoff. Those are good things, but over the longer term, and we're talking about years of both the FBI and the ATF refusing to come to grips with what was going on in Elohim City, in the longer term, you've got to figure these are the law enforcement agencies of the United States. They have to do their job, and I had people from the FBI who felt very strongly that the FBI and the ATF had absolutely not done their job, and that was actually cause for scandal that should have been looked into at the time, and it's still something that should be looked into now because, of course, the threats have not gone away. Interagency rivalry is still, you know, a real problem, even though the ATF and the FBI theoretically have the same bosses now at the Justice Department, and on and on. And also, again, you know, this abiding focus on the Middle East, which I'm not saying is displaced, but it comes often at the budgetary and resource and attention-related expense of focusing on the threat from domestic groups.
But there does seem to be a double standard, though, in this country in terms of subversion. It's always people on the left are always considered to be far more subversive than people on the right. And, you know, you've got, you know, recently even Ted Cruz was talking about the idea that Obama was influenced by communists. And and of course, a number of people have spoken out about the idea that we've had. Well, you go back to the McCarthy era, and the legacy of that lives on. It does seem that we our authorities are a lot more circumspect about making links to right-wing terrorism and right-wing subversion as being a greater danger, which it clearly is. I mean,
No, it's absolutely pertinent to what happened in Oklahoma City. The FBI, after Watergate, was heavily constrained in making sure that they just focused on criminal investigation, but that didn't bleed into intelligence work, you know, in the wake of COINTELPRO and all those revelations of the FBI spying on the anti-war movement. They violated those guidelines when it came to left-wing groups protesting U.S. policy in Central America in the 1980s and got into a lot of trouble for it. They then used the trouble they got into monitoring the left as an excuse not to monitor the right. And, you know, that there's a whole documentary trail, people I spoke to, who show that very clearly. And there's also another problem, which is, you know, the great unspoken problem of guns. The right-wing radicals tend to love their guns even more than left-wing radicals. And the ATF in particular feels politically very tied in terms of how much they can go after people with guns and explosives because of the power of the gun lobby and, you know, the very lax laws that allow access to this kind of stuff in the first place. And there's also, I think, a shared culture there that the law enforcement agents themselves like guns. They understand why people like guns. They understand why they like, you know, powerful weapons, semi-automatic weapons. They understand why people would want to fantasize about taking a semi-automatic weapon and converting it to full automatic to use in their backyard. And although that's, you know, highly illegal, always has been, remains so, I think there's probably a degree of leeway that these groups are given. The people who are complaining about U.S. policy from the left, who are talking about what they can do about it, even if they have no violent intention at all, are viewed much more skeptically, even though they're much less dangerous.
Well, but clearly, you know, there are links, ideological links, between the far right and the Tea Party, and they just seem to get a free pass. And as I say, the comparison on the left is pretty milquetoast compared to these guys. So,
right. I mean, I think it's important to understand that even, you know, within the radical right, or, you know, the far right, let's call it, you have different gradations across the spectrum. And I think the Tea Party would fall into the broad category of people who talk the talk. They aren't necessarily going to walk the walk of killing people, blowing things up, starting a revolution. Mm-hmm. But that rhetorical bulk of people out there talking, making the talking points, complaining about the government, creating an atmosphere in which the more radical activities seem less aberrant, sure, is something that's crucially important to the people who really do pose a danger. So that's how I would categorize it. I don't think your average Tea Party, and no matter how much they talk about shooting Obama's head off or whatever they say, are going to do anything, but that creates a tone and it creates an atmosphere in which more radical things can occur.
Well, Andrew Gumbel, I thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as a foreign correspondent for The Guardian in Europe, the Middle East, and the United States, and the author of several books, including Steal This Vote and Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. His latest article at The Guardian is Oklahoma City Bombing 20 Years Later, Key Questions Remain Unanswered. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.